And now, The Low Post.
Welcome to The Low Post podcast on the last Friday before the start of the 2018-19 NBA season. And to preview that season, we have the one and only making his long-awaited return to the Low Post podcast, the great Jeff Van Gundy. How you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm hanging in. Good summer?
Pretty good. How about yourself?
All ready to go. Got no choice. The season is here. Let's start right off with the biggest story in the league, and that's Jimmy Butler and whatever the hell happened at practice 2 days ago, and then there was no practice yesterday, which I find hilarious. This has been going on now. Well, it's actually interesting. There is some debate about how long it's going on, but the formal trade request is about 3 weeks old. He has still not been traded. They opened the season on Wednesday against the Spurs, I think. Obviously, you know Tom very well. I know Tom much less well. I suspect you've talked to him through this. I have not. This is a situation that I just don't remember a parallel for this, and specifically a parallel for what reportedly happened. I wasn't there in practice on Wednesday. I mean, I don't even know where to start. I suspect you have some insight into this. What do you think is the end game here? Is he actually going to play for them?
Well, first of all, like I don't have really any insight during the season. You know, it's not like I talk to Tom, you know, daily or anything like that. So he's got bigger things to do than talk to friends. But
yeah,
I think this is like I've been interested on a number of different fronts. One, the whole practice scenario, if that's how it evolved. It's just so wrong on so many levels. And yet the media today tends to fawn over players and their agents because that's how they get their information. Right. And so like, I didn't see anyone taking Jimmy Butler to task at, if he did act like that. I saw his interview where he said he can't control himself. Is that really an excuse for poor behavior? And so, listen, there's many different leadership styles. Jordan, Kobe Bryant had that I'm going to drive you leadership style, but only the very, very best can lead like that. Leadership is about uniting and inspiring. And to me, both in Chicago with when they had young players there and now in Minnesota, it looks like it's a divisive leadership where you need me and I'm going to tell you what you can't do. And so I find that interesting. And then the whole notion of how teams use the media to try to bully people like Minnesota into trades, like, you know, like Minnesota's holding it up. Well, I would suspect they are. For what I've read that they're being offered, I would hold it up too. I don't want Alan Crabb from the Nets, you know. tell me I'm stupid, but, like, no, I don't want that. And so, like, you know, I read the writers who say, like, oh, they're holding up, they're being difficult. You know, so, I mean, it's very one-sided. But then the other thing I would say is I read this article yesterday that is totally non-believable by me, that Pat Riley supposedly called Tom Thibodeau an MF-er.
Yeah.
I worked for Pat Riley for 4 years. Pat Riley doesn't have to act like a tough guy. He is a tough guy. He doesn't have to leak it out. Like, there's no way Pat Riley leaked that out. Now, somebody in Miami did to try to make Pat Riley appear tough, but he doesn't need that help. There's no way Pat Riley, as professional as he is, ever called Tom Thibodeau a name. I don't buy that. And that's how absurd, to me, it's gotten.
Well, I don't know. I can't comment on the veracity of that. Though let me go one by one. So I have contributed reporting to some of the stories you're referring to about Minnesota being difficult. I think I actually sent Tom a paragraph that I wrote that went into one of the stories, and the gist of that paragraph was a lot of people around the league feel sympathetic to him because look, he was brought in with a mandate to win. He made a trade designed to get them to win. and they won. They would have been a third or fourth seed last year had Jimmy Butler missed 10 games instead of 25 or whatever it is. And everyone is going to kill them if they make this trade. If, and I don't even know if they're going to. I literally have no idea what's going to happen anymore. Everyone's going to kill them if they make the trade and the return is, you know, just okay stuff from Miami. And my point is always going to be, right now, October 12th, I think the only thing that is going to matter that they gave up in the trade for Jimmy Butler, because that's what people are going to kill them for. Oh, you gave up so much for Jimmy Butler and you got so little in return. I think the only thing that's going to matter is Lauri Markkanen. I don't think Chris Dunn is going to matter in the sense that you're going to look at that in 5 years and say, oh my God, they lost a top eight point guard. I don't think Zach LaVine making almost $20 million is going to matter in the sense that you're going to look at him and say, oh my gosh, they lost a top five shooting guard making $20 million a year. It's a bargain contract. Drafting Patton and having him break his foot twice with the pick you got from Chicago, that kind of sore spot, I think Markkanen is the only thing that's going to matter. I just don't think you can look at that trade, no matter what they get in return, and say that was a mistake. Now, the culture that has produced this fiasco is a mistake. It's a problem, and everyone is to blame for it. But I'm going to defend.
I don't look at it like that, though. Like, I don't understand why everybody terms it a fiasco. A fiasco is losing.
Well, practice.
Like Minnesota has. No, but listen, a fiasco, and no one ever wants to talk one-loss records anymore. Sacramento is a fiasco.
Yes.
Right? They have 12 straight years. Minnesota was an absolute fiasco when they went in there. They were god-awful for 14 years not making the playoffs. So they made the playoffs last year. They won 47 games, 16-game improvement. This season hasn't started. Butler's situation, yeah, it's uncomfortable. It's not a fiasco just because someone in the media labels it a fiasco. A fiasco is if you don't win. Like, we've gotten away from the one-loss record, and now we're judging people on style. Like, are they doing the trade or non-trade, as you said, because you don't, no one knows? Like everybody else wants them to. Are they being, you know, because you can learn, you can put a label to anything. Are they being frustrating, or are they being patient? Are they being diligent, or are they being like untenable with their requests? It's all in the eye of the beholder. So I don't look at it like it's a fiasco. I look at it like this is the NBA with social media. Nobody believes, no player believes, no agent believes in team privacy anymore. So the moment something happens, Jimmy Butler already has an interview scheduled. Everybody's got their, you know, call, you know, leaking to their agents to like leak it out to the media to gain favor with that same media. So we don't look at them objectively.
No,
so everybody has an end game in all of this. And so I don't look at it like a fiasco. I look at it, this is NBA business now. I don't say Kawhi Leonard's thing last year was a fiasco. Like, this is the NBA. This is the NBA we want because this is the NBA we pay attention to. We love drama. We don't necessarily, there's a lot of fans who don't love the game.
I agree. I think.
But they love the drama.
I think the game is too often secondary. I completely agree. I did a podcast about this with Will Leach like three summers ago where we talked about ahead of free agency how, and I think the NBA head office is okay with this. Free agency is more interesting to people than like basketball. And I get that. We all want to be fantasy GMs and everything. I do think, and I sound like an old man. I get it. I do think the game is a little bit getting lost. But that's a different story. Here's what I meant by fiasco. What happened in practice yesterday or whenever, Wednesday, that's a fiasco. It's a fiasco. The culture being so, culture is the wrong word. Whatever is going on between Towns and Butler and Wiggins and the team's inability to get over that, to get everyone on the same page, to have Jimmy Butler yelling at Karl Anthony Towns is a fiasco to me. Now, to go back, I do think, I don't know if it's by accident or on purpose, but I do think that there's sort of like a crazy like a fox thing going on here with Tibbs. Like if he wants Butler back and he thinks they can win games and keep going in Minnesota instead of having the old organization blow up, like, he's played his cards right. Like, in a weird way, objectively, they are moving towards a scenario that he wants. I bet he was happy with how practice went down the other day. I don't know. I haven't talked to him.
Oh, I would disagree. I would.
You don't think so?
Listen, I don't. And again, I haven't spoken to him about this, but no coach believes if what you read that Butler did
right
actually happened, which I don't know if it did or didn't, but let's say it did. There is absolutely no coach
that wants that.
I heard Jimmy Butler say, oh, Tibbs was smiling. No way. I guarantee every coach believes in order, in unity, in togetherness, and pulling in the same direction. And this idea that a coach would be fine with that or good with that. Now, there's a different, like, trash talk is no longer. Like, the one thing that I've learned from coaching my USA basketball team is every bus ride used to be contentious. There used to be debates going on every bus ride about everything. Who's better than who? Should you get a prenuptial agreement or should you not? Like, all this stuff, right? And it was every day, all the time. Now, when I ride even buses with the USA basketball, I've asked other coaches about this. It's silence. Absolute silence, because everybody's got their headphones on their phone, looking at whatever they look at or listening to whatever they're listening to. And so team communication is so much different. But the idea that a coach would be, like, trash talk is one thing. What I read was something overboard.
It wasn't to help
drive a team. Yeah, it wasn't to help drive a team towards winning. And that's the other thing. If I hear one more time, player X is all about winning, I'm going to throw up that the media keeps putting it out there and buying it just because they're being bought off by agents and players. Well, there is no player, no coach, no owner, no general manager that's all about winning. They want to make money, and they want to do it in the place that they want to do it in. And, yes, they also would like to win, but it's not by anybody all about winning. So I just get so sick of hearing the cliches that get thrown out, and now they're talking about with Butler. But it's ridiculous to say this is all about winning. To me, this is all about many things. I don't know what they are, but it's certainly not all about winning.
Well, this leads me to a point that I was really hoping to make on this podcast, and it's in a column that may or may not be coming out this weekend. To me, like, the biggest kind of unasked – it might not even be an unasked question. I think it's an overlooked question is, okay, Jimmy wants to leave Minnesota, right? All he cares about is winning. I look around at Golden State. There's all this noise about Kevin Durant. I don't know what Kevin Durant's going to do. Nobody knows what Kevin Durant's going to do. But those four stars in their primes, that's not going to exist in 2 or 3 years. Even if all four are on the team, they'll be at the edge of their primes and starting to decline. I bet one of them's not there. I don't know. Let's just spitball. Chris Paul's 34. Utah is a rising power. Denver is too. If Jimmy Butler, like, Karl Anthony Towns must be absolutely personally insufferable for Jimmy Butler to look around the landscape of the league and say, okay, I'm 29. I've had knee problems. I can play with this dude who's 22 and literally went 50, 40, 85 last season and might go down as the most versatile scoring big man in the history of the league by the time it's all said and done. 50, I think it was actually 55, 40, 85. He can go 50, 40, 90 on high volume, score from the post, pick and roll, you name it. I can play with that dude in the Western Conference, where the Warriors will eventually break up her age, where the Rockets will eventually break up her age. I can play with that guy. Or I can go to Miami and play with who? I can go to Brooklyn? Who is coming to join me in Brooklyn? No,
but that's what I'm saying. All about winning.
I completely agree. Like, I don't know what went wrong in Minnesota for him. Now, forget Wiggins. I can understand being out on Wiggins. Wiggins has done nothing in the NBA. He's gotten worse almost every season. He's a complete question mark to me going forward. He hasn't lived up to his. I get it. But Karl Anthony Towns is what every guy who's 29 to 31 should be looking at and saying, I want to play with that guy. Now, look, Did he try on defense last year all the time? No. He has a long way to go on that. There's a lot of buzz that he cares about his numbers. He's a little bit soft. He didn't look so excited to post up in the Rocket series on switches. All that, whatever. He's 22, whatever he is. Like, that guy can carry my ass in 4 years when he's putting up 28 and 12 on 50, 40, 90 shooting. We get one more guy in here. We're going to be a serious team. I don't know. How is Miami going to be a serious team? How is Brooklyn going to be a serious team? Now, Philly with Jimmy Butler is a serious team. And I do think Jimmy Butler had eyes for Philly, and Philly just hasn't had eyes for him. But I completely agree. Like, I don't know what it is. There's some puzzle piece missing about what happened between Jimmy Butler and Karl Anthony Towns, or why there is so much distaste there. But like, that's a dude I want to hitch my wagon to if I'm 30 with a lot of miles on me. And I don't, he doesn't seem to want to.
Well, my thing is, listen, Towns has shown no ability to drive winning,
no.
Right? So on that, I get it, right? So, and how do you drive winning? You do the hard things, like defense, like pass the ball willingly, all those things, like making the tough 50-50 ball plays, all right? Is that in Towns' DNA? It hasn't been. May it turn?
But I'm not giving up. I'm not giving up on that after one season.
No, but that's my point. What is leadership? Leadership is trying to show players that aren't there the way to do things. Come with me. It'll be worth it. Follow me. It'll be worth it. And try to help them progress versus run them down. Like, I don't understand that type of leadership. Now, did Jordan pull it off? That was his thing. Did Bryant pull it off? That was his thing. But only the truly, truly, truly elite can lead like that. Duncan, Nash, the long history of great leaders that have encouraged their way to great leadership and encouraged their teammates to bring out more of them than they knew they had in them. That is leadership. So this idea that this is all about winning. If it was all about winning, it would be encouraging. If it was all about winning, he'd be, to me right now, he would be, let me help you guys win. And then if they trade me, they trade me. If they don't, I'm here. And at the end of the year, I'll make the decision that's best for me. I get that. But you can count on me because I signed my contract. I want to earn my pay, and I'm going to do right by the team. So listen, does Towns have holes? Absolutely. Has he proven he can be the best player on a good team? No, not yet. Could he be with the right encouragement and leadership from another great player? I think so.
I don't want to belabor this because we want to talk about the season, but here's an excerpt from Rachel's interview with Jimmy Butler. And she goes into the scenario that has been floated about how Jimmy wanted Minnesota to get far enough under the cap to give him a max level extension that would have kicked in this season. And they would have had to get like $10 million below the cap or something, which would have involved literally gutting their roster. And it was not possible. And then they get into a discussion about whether it's about the money. And here's what I'm going to read. It's not about the money. It's not, Jimmy says. Rachel says, so tell me what it's about. And here's Jimmy's monologue about what this dispute is about. It's about saying we need you. We want you here. We can't do this without you. And that was the disconnect all along. You're saying one thing and you're saying it and you're saying it. I mean, I've learned enough times in life that saying something is completely different than acting upon it. Actions speak louder than words, whatever quote you want to use. And when it came to that point, it was like I let you all know what the deal was as soon as you traded for me. I told you the truth from day one and I will continue to do it. And I did it. It's kind of like, I don't know, a slap in the face. I don't know how to put it, but it made me think like maybe I'm not that important to your organization. That is how I took it. That's gobbledygook. That's gibberish. That says nothing. That is how I took it. Took what? What is he talking about? What's a slap in the face? It's not about money, but this was a slap in the face. So they have to tell me that I'm needed. Actions speak louder than words. If you just read that paragraph, just isolate that paragraph, that's just nothing. That's gobbledygook. I still don't know what he's talking about. Anyway, I don't.
But I'm going to say this. This is the thing. You've got to learn. Athlete talk, coach speak. They're both foreign languages, and everybody needs an interpreter, right?
But that's gibberish.
And the interpretation is this. When a player says it's not all about money, just remember this. It is about money. That's what they really mean. And when they say it's all about winning, remember this. It means it's all about winning, .. if I get my own way. Okay? So if he wanted them to gut their team and, like, trade everybody so they could pay him a little bit more, yes, that might be respect for him or more respect in his eyes, however that becomes respect. But it would have been bad for the team. So is that all about winning? And if they had done that and then they couldn't win because of that, then he would have been unhappy, I would say, because look at the roster you put around me. So, listen, I don't know much about this situation, but I do know this. Minnesota was in terrible shape when Thibodeau came in. They made a good trade. Whether it turns out like they, you know, like you said, Markkanen, like, I like him a lot. And I think Chicago made a good trade, too. So whether it turns what it turns out to, I want to wait and see. But the one thing I wouldn't do, I wouldn't be bullied if I was Minnesota. And the owner has to bear the responsibility of losing and now, like, making solid decisions. Don't get pushed around. Don't get pushed into, like, a fake timetable that you have to trade him by. Don't get pushed by your business people, like, you know, we're having trouble selling tickets or something like that.
They're afraid of the booze and the atmosphere.
Yeah,
and all
who cares?
That's real. That's very real within the organization.
And who cares, right? You were in the playoffs for 14 straight years. Worry about that. Worry about winning, putting a good product out there. And so I don't know what is going to happen, whether he stays and plays, whether he stays and sits out, whether they trade him now, later. My whole point, like, this is where if you're Scott Layden, Tom Thibodeau, Glenn Taylor, you got to be united and you've got to be strong. Because if you're weak-minded with everybody coming at you, working for different factions through the media, agents and all that, you can do something that will set your team back for a long period of time, and they're coming out of a deep, dark period of 14 years prior to last year of not making the playoffs.
And
you could be Sacramento.
Being united brings me back to your original point about them being difficult to deal with. All I've meant by that in my reporting is you had teams telling stories of Glenn would call us and ask to talk to our owner, and then Tibbs would call us and ask to talk to our GM, and we didn't know who to talk to. We got cross messages from both of them. But this is 2.5 weeks ago, and, like, multiple teams are actually talking. That's all I meant by that. Jimmy is a great – let me be clear. Jimmy is a great player. They were a very good team, a 55-60 win level team in terms of point differential with Jimmy on the floor last year, and a trash fire without him. He's somewhere between the 8th and 12th best player in the NBA, an absolute beast. Absolute beast. Like, there's no dispute about that. Like,
Absolutely not. I agree with you totally. He's a good competitor who's multidimensional. And his story prior to – I didn't really like how he ended in Chicago that year, trashing the young players. I didn't like necessarily even like last year some of the stuff that was emanating, like his disdain for those two guys. But – as far as a player and a competitor and his story about where he was drafted to now, I have great respect for him.
I just don't
have a lot of respect for if he did what they say he did at practice and that sort of stuff. I got no respect for that.
And I keep hearing from people who are maybe critics of his or teams that are not going to trade for him. Oh, but you can't win a championship with Jimmy Butler as your best player. Okay, well, how many guys fit that description then? Four? How many do we know for sure can be the best player in a championship team? So Jimmy Butler, that's his shortcoming, is that he can't be the best player in a championship team. I'll tell you this, he's good enough that if you found him a guy that was just as good as him, so you got two guys who are the eighth or ninth best players in the league, you got a shot in a normal NBA where four of the top 15 players in the league are not on the same team, including two of the top three. In a normal NBA, Jimmy Butler as co-alpha dog in his prime with another guy that good, you got a chance. The season is starting, and there are 29 other teams in the league. Want to bounce around and do some big questions with me?
Sure.
Last year, you were on the Golden State inevitability train until about game 60, where you pivoted and evidence suggested that you should have, and others did as well, and said Houston's got a shot. And then Houston took them to seven, and Chris Paul got hurt, and they wiped them out in game six and seven, and won the championship. So where are we entering this season? Is it inevitable? And if not, who is the challenger?
Well, last year, you know, Houston, correct me if I'm wrong, was up at halftime in both game six
both
and
games.
Seven.
Yeah, if you pause Double games digits, at halftime, right? They were in great shape.
Yeah, and that wasn't to win the Western Conference. That was to win the championship. So they had an injury that impacted them, but they still had their shot. They've made some changes in the offseason. I think Daryl will not stay pat. I think he'll continue to tinker. I'm interested about everything Houston does, everything from Bezdelic leaving to Anthony coming in and everything in between. I still think it's those two in the Western Conference. I think Golden State will be the number one seed. I think they'll try harder in the regular season this year.
I do too.
I also think in the Eastern Conference, Boston would have a shot against either one because of their defensive versatility. I think they're going to – I'm interested to watch Boston try to share the shots and the minutes when fully healthy, because they do have such great, great depth. And so I think, yeah, Boston would have a chance, but, I mean, I think, again, it's still Golden State clearly the team. I think Houston's the second-best team, but Boston is going to be there lurking, and I think they'll be in the finals, and – I think whoever comes out of the West, Boston's got a good chance against.
Let's unpack a few of those things. Golden State is clearly still the favorite. They reside in a tier of their own. Their star power is ridiculous.
By the way, I have a question for you on that. I read somewhere this summer, I don't know if you concur, people already have Draymond Green in the Hall of Fame. Are you one of them?
You know, I how many All-Star teams has he made? Is he up to four now? I mean, the history of the Hall of Fame suggests, although it's actually interesting that, the history of the Hall of Fame suggests that if you are a top four player on a, he's a three-time All-Star, on a dynastic team, you get in, dating to the 60s Celtics. Now, Horace Grant hasn't got in. Rodman did. Rodman was a key player on two. Mini dynasties, I guess, three Bulls, two Pistons, and then beyond that. You know, if he gets up to five, I think the people who are saying that are assuming, you know, the Warriors win four or five titles and he makes five or six All-Star games. And at that point, you are in, I think. If you pause right now, he breaks his leg tomorrow and never plays again. Whew, that's a tough one.
Really? Wow, okay.
You think he's out, period. He never plays again after today. He's not a Hall of Famer.
Oh, no, absolutely not.
Okay. Yeah. You know, you might be right. I mean, I'd have to look at
I'm just saying, like, I
you know what? He's only played 6 years. He's only played 6 years in the league. So, yeah, you're probably – he's not in the Hall of Fame if all stops today. You don't get in the Hall of Fame normally for playing 6 years, even if you are the third best player on a dynasty. I think those people are projecting forward, don't you think?
Even so, I don't think it's as simple as that. You know, I was looking at other people's numbers, you know, like Horace Grant or Charles Oakley or, you know, all these people. I'm just, again, to me, it's just a new time. Like,
Is Clay in?
I wouldn't think. Well, I wouldn't think so yet. His numbers are bigger. But I wouldn't say yet, no. I mean, the two guys on their team that are definitely in are, you know, Curry and Durant. I think everybody else has work to do. Those two guys, you know, they stop tomorrow. Yeah, they're in.
How about this? Is Steve Kerr in?
You know, I think coaches, like, I don't have, like, a great feel for how pro coaches get in there. College coaches get in the Hall of Fame, like... Everybody that wins 500 games is in. They should just have a rule. Like, you win 500, you're in, right?
I should have known this was good. It is true. Yeah, it is
like,
true.
Like, in the NBA, Rudy Tomjanovich won two championships and he's not in, I don't get it.
You're preaching to the preacher on that one. When we did our all snubs.
He was a terrific player, a terrific coach. He's been a longtime scout. He's done so much for the game. The international component for Rudy when he didn't have NBA players and he took him to, I forget what competition was, but I think he got the bronze. To me, the guy's been like a star. So I don't know how coaches are judged anymore from an NBA perspective, if they get in or not. But I think if you say like three championships, has anybody won three championships and not gotten in?
I don't think so. I think Steve will be in.
Absolutely, then.
Yeah, I think Steve will be in. Anyway, so let's go back to the season. Does when you think about the Warriors and their inevitability or possible inevitability, which is an oxymoron, does DeMarcus Cousins like even enter your thoughts? Have you gotten to the point where you've envisioned how he fits or worried about what he might do to their chemistry, or is he just literally like a bonus that they can kick to the side if it doesn't work out for whatever reason? Do you even like care that DeMarcus Cousins is on the Warriors?
Yeah, because I don't think their roster is as deep. You have to say, do you know Damian Jones can play those Pachulia, 14 minutes in a finals and play him well? Do you know? I feel good about Looney to an extent, and Bell, they're okay, right?
Yeah.
But this is not the depth of talent where they have old veteran grizzled experience. I think Cousins is going to be incredibly important. And that means from a positive standpoint, if they win it, I would be a little concerned about our turnover rate with him, because they have some risk-taking players. Spacing is an issue. How many threes, he's going to take. And that injury is not easy to come back from in year one, right? And so I'm interested in all of it. But he's unquestionably gives them a talent level at that position that they had not had. What you can't yet see is the impact it may or may not have from either a positive standpoint or a negative standpoint on the other players, right? It's impossible to say right now, but I think it's very, very intriguing to watch.
And I think that DeMarcus is not going to want to hear this, but, I mean, what you said about what can we get for those, 18 center minutes before we play the backup center, and then before we go with Draymond at center down the stretch, because that's still, to me, their best lineup, unless Andre Iguodala's body breaks down or whatever. DeMarcus isn't going to want to hear that, but that's where he lifts the team, is just, those 18 minutes, he's better than the other guys. Houston,
ask you to say one more thing about Iguodala?
Sure.
Why is he not getting, consideration for the Hall of Fame then?
If you look at his numbers. I have raised that very question on this podcast.
If you're going to say those four are in, and you look at Iguodala and what he did with other teams before he went to the Warriors, his numbers are good. And so obviously now he takes a back seat or whatever. I think sometimes we give too much credit when we look at the Hall of Fame to team success, because should I be given credit because I played with all-time greats? I don't know. But that's how it's morphed into. But I think Iguodala, in importance and also in longevity and productivity, he'd have to be then considered as well.
Not a lot of one-time All-Stars in the Hall of Fame. There are not a lot of finals MVPs who are not in the Hall of Fame. I don't think he makes it. I don't think he quite deserves it. But I will say this. I think we will look back on this Andre Iguodala on the Warriors era and kick ourselves that he never won Sixth Man of the Year. We always give Sixth Man of the Year to a guy who scores a lot of points, which is fine. Lou Williams deserved it last year. I voted for him. I think I voted for him when he won it for Toronto too. But I definitely voted for Iguodala at least once. And, I think this will happen with Terry Rozier this year. he will maybe not, he'll play 8 minutes less per game than a couple of the other candidates and not put up the raw numbers, and voters will punish him because he's on too good of a team, because he's the best bench player on a really good team versus the guy who's the best bench player and becomes a de facto starter because two of the starters are worse than him. I just like, we punished Andre Iguodala because the team is too good. And also, you know, there were some regular seasons he didn't try as hard as all the time, and that's Andre, but like the guy was the best bench player in the league at some point during this Warriors run and never won Sixth Man of the Year.
Well, I think that's interesting because we preach that we want players to sacrifice for the good of the team, and then when they do, we punish them when we're considering individual awards.
I better make sure I go back. I go back and make sure I voted for him. I'm pretty sure I did at least once. Maybe even before I had a ballot, I put him at number one. Anyway, I'll have to go double check my own voting record. Houston, I find your take interesting because I am on the same page as you that Houston is still the second best team in the West and maybe the second best team in the league. I'm surprised how many people disagree, how many people say their championship window has closed because Ariza and Bamute are on different teams. And there's like this groundswell of Utah is going to win more games than Houston, that notion. To what degree do those Ariza, you mentioned Bezdelic and Bamute, to what degree do those actually worry you? Is it just a Warriors matchup thing? Are we overblowing those losses? Can James Ennis effectively become Trevor Ariza? What is your take on all that?
Well, I think Ariza was a big loss. He's a good player. That's why Phoenix gave him $15 million a year, right? So I think he's a loss, but I think, you know, Harden is so great and Paul is so great. And they play so differently because, you know, they'll pound that ball forever. And they have Capella rolling to the rim, and they surround him with shooters. And I think they're just going to be unbelievable again offensively. So I'm not as concerned with them. Now, will they win 65 games again? I wouldn't think so, but I think they're going to be up in the mid to high 50s. I think Utah and Denver to me are 3 and 4. I think Utah is terrific.
Ooh, you're high on Denver. We agree on too many things this year. I'm high on Denver.
Right. I think, well, first of all, being third last year, what was it, a one game, two game difference?
I'm so sick of hearing the Blazer fans. How dare you doubt us this year? We were third in the West last year. Okay, great. You were two games up on ninth. You know, it doesn't matter to me that you're third.
Right, so there, it's all jumbled. I'm high on the Clippers, too. I think the Clippers are going to have a really good year.
Ooh, that was one of my questions to come later.
Yeah, so I think, you know, 3 through 10 in the Western Conference is going to be brutal. A lot of it's going to be health, chemistry, whatever, trade here or there. But I think Utah is going to separate itself. I think Denver will separate themselves. I think they'll both be, you know, low 50s, mid 50s. I think they're that good. Utah with Gobert is there. The defense is outstanding. And, you know, offensively, I think they have a little bit more versatility than people give them credit for.
Their offense this year is going to be very interesting to me because they exploded in the second half of the season. Even though they, you know, and they had this small ball closing lineup with Crowder that lit the world on fire, but Favors, Gobert, Rubio, which looked unplayable for the first half, exploded. And Mitchell, obviously, he's the trump card that you need. You know, all your handoffs and screens and cuts and all that stuff, like, that's cool. The whole league watched Houston switch everything against them and said, oh, that's interesting. Maybe we should be a little more aggressive doing that against Utah in the regular season. But then you have Mitchell, and that's the trump card to that strategy. I think where they rank on offense, are they 15th? Are they 6th? Is going to be one of the sort of more interesting questions of the season. Houston did win 65 last year. I agree it's unlikely. You know, Harden missed 10 games, and Paul missed 20-something. It's not like they had perfect health and got to 65. They gutted out 65, and I do think we've got to have reached the point now where Harden, he's got his MVP. Just dial it back a little bit like all these other stars do so you're not gassed in the playoffs every year, although LeBron, of course, didn't do that last year trying to win the MVP.
I don't buy that gas thing. That's
you don't
a
think
myth.
So?
That's a myth. Did you ever say that about Jordan? Dial it back? Like, what is this now? Like, you can't try in the regular season and be ready for in the playoffs when you have so many more days of rest? Well, I mean, no one tries. The Rockets don't shoot around and don't practice very much. It's possible, if you're Mike D'Antoni, to pace your team on off days like he has. I mean, they have plenty of rest. So you don't want them to practice, shoot around, or play? I don't understand. Then what are we paying these guys for? I think it's the biggest myth. Every time there's a problem now, we wait to see what happens, and then we say, oh, they tried too hard in the regular season, or he tried too hard. Like, what great thing in America has ever happened without hard work? How did anything great be accomplished going through the motions, not trying your best? Is that our new motto in the NBA? Don't try? I don't buy it. And I don't think there's any scientific proof. You know, we're all on this sports scientist. Show me the science that James Harden didn't play great because of fatigue and not because the other team he was competing against was great.
Well, first of all, I'm glad you brought up America, but I have to say the proximity of the words great and America, I had like an involuntary spasm. Something happened to James Harden against the Spurs 2 seasons ago, and then of course they missed 9,000 threes against the Warriors last year. It's just something you hear, and you hear it from the Rockets too, and the Jordan comparison.
It's called excuse making. It's not called, hey, James Harden, I did that game. They got beat by 39, I believe, at home in Game 6 after losing a heartbreaker in Game 5.
Yes.
If they had won Game 5, is anybody going to say they were too tired to win Game 6? No. What happened was Leonard didn't play, Parker didn't play for whatever reason. Harden was terrible in that game, but so was every other Rocket. And no one else was saying, oh, Harden went – like something that happened. He tried too hard in January, so in late May, he was unable to perform well. It's a joke. And there's absolutely, from what I've read, no science that has ever proven these things. So what Houston was doing, they were covering for Harden. He played awful. He looked disinterested in Game 6. Guess what?
Interesting.
A lot of teams have done that. A lot of teams have had bad games. And a lot of great players have had bad games. And this excuse-making for it, oh, he was too tired. No, sometimes teams play bad. Sometimes individual players play bad. Sometimes coaches coach bad. And sometimes you just go up against a better opponent. And on that night, the thing I have a problem with, Game 6 against San Antonio 2 years ago, it was one of the greatest performances I've ever seen by an opposing team on the road, considering the circumstances and the people out, that has ever been witnessed in the NBA, and not one thing was talked about how great San Antonio was that night. It was all about, oh, Harden, and then Harden was too tired, and the Rockets, and what, I mean, that was an incredible performance by the Spurs.
It was, that's fair, and part of that is the NBA is a stars league. The stars drive, the top 15 players in the league drive so much of who can contend for a title, and when one of those guys has a bad game, that's naturally going to be the story. Now, is there science? There is science. Is there scientific proof? Is there a scientific line connecting point A to point B? I don't know that, but certainly we can measure players' loads and all that. I don't want to belabor this. But the Jordan comparison is interesting because Jordan made a bunch of all defense teams. He played every game. He played both ends, every possession. There is this idea that because of the stylistic changes in the game, that players have to move more defensively because of how many threes are shot and how many rotations have to be made. Now, Houston did soften that a little bit last year by just switching everything, so that you didn't have to rotate and fly around the floor. I do think it is exhausting to run 50 pick and rolls every single game and dribble and dribble and dribble and ISO and ISO and ISO and drive and kick. To have that burden on you every game is physically and mentally taxing, but Michael had a similar burden, just stylistically different. It's an interesting debate.
But also, we never say that after great games. We never say that. Oh, he was so tired. He played great. We always wait till a guy plays bad, and then we give him this crutch. Oh, he must have been too tired. Westbrook, why does no one ever say Westbrook's too tired? No one ever says when Westbrook plays bad, he was too tired, because he always has great energy, right? He plays with great energy, but that doesn't mean he's not tired. I just find it like if you're not a little fatigued by the end of the season, you haven't done it right. And I go back to the Warriors. When the Warriors lost to the Cavaliers, the excuse was, Curry didn't play great because Curry's knee. All right? We never give credit to the opponent anymore. It's always some excuse why the other team lost versus, hey, we just got outplayed.
I think that happened in the conference finals last year when Houston was up. And a lot of the talk was, oh, the Warriors are in their own heads. You know, Durant's being they're going against their identity and isoling. And you know, when the Warriors start playing better, now the Warriors did start playing better and they won. And there was an injury that was important too. But I did not think Houston got enough credit for at least having the talent and playing the kind of system that could nudge the Warriors toward a different style of basketball, towards bad habits and all that. Anyway, let's not belabor Houston. We're on the same page about Houston. They're going to be really good. You mentioned Boston. Why is Boston better than Toronto? Because you said Boston's going to make the finals. You didn't mention Toronto. So tell me why Boston is better.
Well, I shouldn't have. I guess I should hold my. I'm going against myself. I'm not sure they're going to have a better regular season record. You got to give Toronto credit. Like, they have been very good for a long time. Now, they made a coaching change to me, which made no sense, but they did. But they got Kawhi Leonard. Now, I don't know what Kawhi Leonard they got. Is he an excited Kawhi Leonard? Is he a healthy Kawhi Leonard? We'll find out. But obviously, if he's all those things, he's a great, great player. And he's better than DeRozan. And that's not a knock on DeRozan, because I think DeRozan is a really, really good player, and he's proven it. But Leonard is better. And so I think Valanciunas has improved greatly in his time in Toronto. I do like Fred VanVleet. Lowry, to me, has had a career renaissance there in the regular season, not as good in the playoffs. So you're right. I shouldn't have been so quick to anoint Boston as the top seed. So I'll take that back. But I think Boston, the way they're constructed from a defensive standpoint, I think they're going to be elite, elite. And I think in the playoffs, they can do with their switching even more than Houston could do with theirs. And I just think they're better built to withstand injury. The only thing that can get in Boston's way, to me, to have an incredible year this year is they don't share well. They don't share the minutes and they don't share the ball. And I don't see that as a problem for them.
I was hell-bent on Boston is going to have the best record in the NBA. And the preseason has wavered me a little bit because Hayward is behind what he hoped to be. He's talked about it. Their offense looks a little behind. I mean, I keep hearing about how their practices are unbelievable, their pickup games are unbelievable, and then they look bleh in the actual games. I don't read a lot into preseason, but sometimes the stuff you see does matter. But I think Boston 1-8 is 1-9 is more talented than Toronto by a little bit. Now the one, Toronto has the edge, and usually the one carries the day. And as you said, they can throw out some lineups where it's like when they have Anunoby, Green, Leonard, Lowry, Siakam, whatever, Ibaka at center, whatever. I mean, they're going to be a hellacious defensive team. If you told me they had the best defense in the NBA, I wouldn't even be surprised. Like, I think it'll be Utah, Philly, Boston all be in that conversation. I think Toronto's going to be in that conversation. But I just think the talent of Boston's fourth, fifth, sixth best players is just better than Toronto's fourth, fifth, sixth best players. And it's kind of close, but I think Boston's talent is better. And I just think some of those guys are so good. Like Jaylen Brown might be the fifth best player on the Celtics. Terry Rozier is the sixth best, whatever you want to say. Those
guys
are
darn good.
They're
pretty darn good.
Yeah, they're so good that makes up for the gap between Kawhi and whoever the best player on the Celtics is, which when Gordon Hayward is healthy, I think is a matter of some debate. That is the one playoff series in all this sort of mini era of the Eastern Conference that we have not seen is Toronto-Boston. I want to see it. That said, Philly-Boston was just a wonderful time last year, and seeing that rivalry rekindled was awesome. But that would be a fun series. And Toronto, look, we all make fun of them in the playoffs. They get rolled out every year with one exception, and it was a bad exception. It was when Washington swept them in the 2015 playoffs, I think, in the first round, totally embarrassed them, humiliated them. They almost made a coaching change then. With that exception, it's only been LeBron. Now, there are other postseason victories, like over the year they beat Indiana and Miami in back-to-back seven-game series. It wasn't like exactly inspiring, but it's not like they've embarrassed themselves against any team other than LeBron's team. However, they did embarrass themselves against LeBron's team last year, and the Celtics almost beat them without two of their three best players. So I give Boston a little bit of an edge. Let's go to the bottom of the East. And you can disagree with this presumption if you want. I will presume that Toronto, Philadelphia, Boston, Milwaukee, Indiana, where there is some disagreement, and Washington, where there is a lot of disagreement, I will presume that those six are in. If you want to disagree with me about Washington, fine. I just think they will talent their way to 45 wins, and that's enough. That leaves me at least four teams for two spots. Miami, Charlotte, Detroit, maybe just three teams. Who am I forgetting? Miami, Charlotte, Detroit. You can throw in Brooklyn if you want.
No, you can't throw in Brooklyn. No, there's nothing negative about that. Like, I like Jared Allen a lot. I mean, they just don't have the talent. You know, they're going to do a lot of great things. Kenny Atkinson, I think, does a wonderful job. They just don't have a lot of talent.
I'm kind of optimistic the Nets can crash the party because I just find all these teams so blah. I agree with you. They need a ball handler to pop this year. Because as cute as all that stuff is, and look, Kenny, they play the right way on both ends of the floor. They allow the right kinds of shots and take the right kinds of shots, and they move the ball. Their wings can all shoot and make good decisions. Like, I think their wings are all right. They need someone who can handle the ball to pop, because at the end of the day, to really win in the NBA, you need someone to break down a defense on his own, and they don't quite have that. We'll see if Dinwiddie can step up, or Russell, who's looked bad, or I like LeVert a lot, but I agree. So, would you pencil Miami in, and that gets us to seven? Do you disagree on Indiana or Washington?
No, I'm interested to see the Howard dynamic with Washington, but Beal, Wall, Otto Porter, like that's going to get them into the playoffs, I would think. Now, does Howard make them overachieve or underachieve? Does he have, you know, John Wall, like, asking to be traded by midseason? I mean, he's had this impact. It's amazing. L.A., Houston, Atlanta, Charlotte, four teams in a row couldn't wait to get rid of him. And it boggles my mind because I watched him, like, every night in Orlando, right? And to go, I don't think I've ever seen a guy go from people loved him and loved his personality to detesting what he stands for by multiple teams in a row, this erosion. Like, I am absolutely shocked to see what's happened with Dwight Howard in his career. And now he's asking to shoot jump shots. And yeah, it just boggles my mind.
Well,
but they're going to still make it. They're still making it.
I hope so.
I wonder if he can get himself together to help them overachieve, like in the playoffs. Because if he wanted to play as a defender, rebounder, screen setter, they would be so dangerous in the playoffs.
Well, we say this every year. He doesn't want to do that. He wants to be Hakeem Olajuwon, except he travels half the time he posts up or and then throws up these jump hooks that hit the glass. And every once in a while he'll plow over someone and dunk and, you know, it looks nice, but it's every once in a while. Miami?
But so, yeah, Miami I think is definitely in.
With or without Butler? Status quo or Butler?
Yeah, I like the, I like, you know, listen, if they can get Butler, it gives them, you know, more range in how good they can become, depending on who they give up. But they can't make a bad trade for Butler. There's not any two players that they could give up that Jimmy Butler coming in wouldn't give them a better chance to win.
Oh, for right? sure.
So, like to me, I think they're in without Butler. If they happen to make a trade for Butler, then I think they have a chance to vault past some of those teams you listed before. And then I think, you know, Detroit, depending on the health of Reggie Jackson, and Charlotte, depending on how they want to rotate their players and how much Monk can improve, I'm interested to follow them.
For some reason, I favor Detroit by a little bit over Charlotte, and I can't even pinpoint why that is. But I'm uninspired by all those teams. Let's go back to the West. Last question, and then we'll let you go. Let's presume Houston, Golden State. Where are my notes? Houston, Golden
Utah.
State, Oklahoma City, Utah, Denver, Lakers. Let's do the Lakers. Are you in on the
Lakers? I'm not assuming them for sure.
Really?
I think that's a jump.
Okay.
Now, I tell you one thing. I hate preseason basketball. I don't even know why it's on. I think it should be banned from TV to help our product.
We're sending
so
our
A no
team.
Watches.
We're sending the you did a pre, did you do a preseason game?
I did, but I did a great preseason game because I got to go to Seattle.
Oh, that's right. You got that one. Yeah.
So yeah. So and Vegas is a great venue for preseason basketball. But getting back to the Lakers, I've been impressed with how hard they've played. Their level of enthusiasm, you know, now I have no idea how it's going to translate once minutes are counted and shots are counted and stats mean something to players. See, it's easy to play unselfish in the preseason because no one cares about numbers and no one actually wants to even play in the games. So once you start counting them, I'm interested to see if Lonzo Ball's okay with 20 minutes or Lance Stevenson getting a DNP, he's fine with that on occasion, or however it shakes out there. Or, you know, James handles the ball, you know, for the predominant amount of time he's on the court, right? So I'm not sure, you know, how good they are. But with James, so I'm not saying they're in. I just can't believe he won't make the playoffs when it comes said and done. I just don't, no matter who plays with him.
I'm with you. I don't think you can build a conference where there are eight teams better than LeBron James at this stage of his career, better than LeBron's team at this stage of his career. And I do think I think they're going to be pretty good. So I don't want to keep you here. We just named six. Okay, you're high on the Clippers, so I'll put them up in this next group. That leaves two spots. I would put the next four as, in some order, as Portland, San Antonio, New Orleans, and if you want the Clippers, I'll give you the Clippers. Who gets in out of those four, or who are you most worried about out of those four? So Portland, Spurs, Pelicans, Clippers.
Oh, I'll go with Portland. And again, I would go with New Orleans if I knew Anthony Davis was going to play 75 games, right? So, but not knowing that, his injury history. So I'm going to go Portland, and I'm going to go Minnesota.
Oh, well, I didn't even mention Minnesota because if they keep Butler, they're in. They're in the in group. They're in the Denver, Utah, that tier. If they keep Butler and somehow make this copacetic, they're in. if they, I'm assuming, I still, for some reason in my head, I'm assuming they're going to trade him. And so I didn't mention them, and that opens up another spot. But yeah, if Minnesota somehow functions, they're going to get in. If they trade Jimmy Butler for 75 cents on the dollar, I think they're out. And then you start to get these other teams. So no Spurs, huh? That's got to feel weird.
No, you know what? I have to open up a ninth spot. I cannot say, no, listen, I'm going back against what I said. When the Spurs don't make the playoffs, then I'll admit that, like, okay, I should have seen this coming, but I'm going to take the Spurs over Minnesota.
Okay.
So, because I just think, like, when I look at their talent, it's underwhelming, right? And yet, they're going to play well. Now, do they have the talent to win with Murray out now? I coached Derek White in the last window with USA Basketball. I think he's going to have a sneaky, really good year. I think he's a talented guy. I think he has to have a turbo booster inserted in him so that he plays with an every night energy and a confidence. But he is big. He has great vision. He can score. He's a great person. I don't know how many minutes they're going to plug him in at.
He might start.
I love him. No, I know. I know they're starting him, but does that mean he's going to play 20 minutes,
sure,
18,
sure,
you know, or is he going to grow so he has to play 28 or 30? I really, really like him. And I just believe their size and their every night defense, you know, they're going to guard. Like, are they going to be top 10, top 8, top 6? I don't know, but they're going to be in that range. And because of that, they're going to be in games. And I think LaMarcus Aldridge is going to have a monster year. Rudy Gay is going to have a good year. And then DeMar DeRozan, I think I would have made the same trade if I was Toronto. But I think San Antonio, for the hand they were dealt, made an outstanding trade. I like DeRozan a lot, and Pirtle's good. And so, like, I think they did well. So Minnesota just got knocked out. That's how convinced I was about Minnesota.
Well, we can move them to the East, maybe. And
first of all, I'm all for the 1-16, too, by the way. I am. I'm all for that. Anytime the NBA wants to put the best teams in, I'm all for.
A novel concept, put the best teams in. Look, I've come to sympathize with their argument a little bit, because they've put out all the numbers about how bad the travel would get. And look, I know what you're going to say. It's all private jets, first class.
No. My thing is this, though. My thing is different. I'd keep conference play. I wouldn't try to make the schedule equal.
No, I wouldn't. I'm with you. Just, you don't have to worry about that. I'm just talking about in the playoffs, if all of a sudden you've got a team flying cross country on a 2-2-1-1-1 series every
poor
round.
Poor guys.
I told you what you were going to say.
The shrimp cocktail may not be quite as chilled by landing time. Oh, man. How devastating. Ugh.
And I do sympathize a little bit with the NBA's argument. This is actually one of their main arguments that they don't publicize as much, is that having two conferences, having effectively two races for the last spot instead of one, puts more teams in play longer into the season. That's something I actually hadn't thought much about until the league people started contacting me about, you know, don't be so gung-ho about 1-16. That's interesting to me. I just still, and they'll say to you, well, are you really that mad? Are you really that mad, Jeff Van Gundy? Are you really that furious that one Eastern Conference team per year with a worse record than a Western Conference team that doesn't make it, that one such team gets in, or 0.8 teams per year, whatever it is, does that actually make you so mad that you're willing to screw up the travel and screw up the playoff races like I just talked about for 0.8, whatever it is, teams per year? And my answer is kind of yes. Like, these East teams stink.
Well,
my answer is still kind of yes.
I would say I don't know about if it's going to be one team or two teams or three teams. I do know this. The final should have the opportunity to have the two best teams. So you're talking about, like, the 8 seeds. I'm talking about
Great
Houston
point.
And Golden State should have had the chance to meet in the finals. And
agreed.
I think the whole Eastern Conference, Western Conference, just like the divisions have been, are an antiquated thought, so too are conferences. I think everything has changed. Like, the mode of travel has changed. The number of days off that the NBA gives has changed. Now they give off 2 days every time they go east to west, right, in the finals, right? There are answers out there if you want to have them. I don't think you can ever say you're wrong as a league if meritocracy wins out, if the best teams have a chance to have a better seed, to make the playoffs. I don't think you can ever go wrong. Am I that mad? Listen, nothing the NBA does except firing coaches for no valid reason makes me that mad, right? But, or some of their rules. But I still think, like, what's wrong with having the best teams in it? What's wrong with having the top two teams, if even if they're in the same conference, have a chance to meet in the finals? You know, are they that attached to the conference alignments? My counter would be, are they that attached to the conference alignments that they don't want to see a seven-game series, Golden State and Houston from last year in the finals?
And look, there are also ways to deal with the travel. I mean, I don't want to keep you here, but there are also ways to deal with the travel. Like, go back to 2-3-2. Go back to 2-3-2 for every round. If you want, Hollinger wrote about this when he still worked here, when they went away from 2-3-2, he wrote this idea that I can't dig up the piece right now, but I believe he wrote a piece that was like this idea that 2-3-2 is less advantageous for the team that's supposed to have home court advantage, that having game five on the road is such a disaster, is false. He did the research and that's why they changed it, because people complained that it was unfair to the team that was seeded higher. If that's really the case, if the math backs up that argument, just do 2-3-2 for everything.
I was against 2-3-2, because I just never think the lower seeded team should ever have more home games possibly than the road team ever. But I agree with you on this. If it meant putting the best teams in 1 through 16, then I'm all for going back to 2-3-2 for every round.
It's an interesting debate. Anyway, you've given us too much of your time, Coach. It's always great to have you. You're unparalleled on TV. I can't wait till the first Breen Van Gundy Jackson broadcast in a real game, and it's good to hear from you. And we'll be checking in as the season goes on, my friend.
All right, take care.
Thanks, Coach. The Low Post is presented by Goodyear. Discover the possibilities. Goodyear, more driven.